Good afternoon. It is 12:02 Friday afternoon, and you know what that means. It's time for our weekly chat with State Senator Jeb Bradley. Also with us is Brody Deshaies, and we're going to be talking with him, too. We'll tell you why coming up. Senator, thanks for calling in, and hope you had a good week.
I did, and hope you did, too. It's good to see the sun.
Yeah.
And, you know, Brody and I went to a great event a week ago, and that was fun, too.
Tell us about it.
So it was the Carroll County, Grafton County, and Coos County Republican committees that had a fundraising affair. U.S. Senator Tom Cotton was the featured speaker, and it was interesting to, you know, get his take. He's a constant contributor on many different TV networks, very well-versed U.S. senator, served in, I know, at least Afghanistan, but I think maybe Iraq, too. He was an Army Ranger, I believe. He's a very capable person, and he was good. It was good. It was good to see friends. You know, as I've been saying on a lot of interviews that I've done recently, Eric, I think we're getting the sense that people are getting back to normal. And so this was one of the first events I had been at like this. Tuesday was up in North Conway, and it was crowded, and a lot of people around enjoying themselves. And, you know, it was great just to sit in front of the Ben and Jerry's store in North Conway and have an ice cream cone and just, you know, feel like things are coming back to normal. I realized that, you know, the Delta variant is with us, but as I've been saying for the last few weeks now, what's different between March of 2020 and July of 2021 is that people know how to protect themselves at this point. They understand the risks. They, you know, I think are well-educated and can protect themselves. We should. Anybody that's had the vaccine, you can still get COVID, no question about it, but the symptoms will be much less deadly, much less severe. So I think that's a good thing. And the other thing that people aren't talking about enough is, you know, there have been 100,000 New Hampshire people that have had COVID, have tested positive for COVID. There are probably more who have had it, but just the symptoms, they may not have gotten tested. And so when you combine the, you know, 100,000 people that have had COVID and nearly 60% of us have been vaccinated, we're approaching herd immunity in New Hampshire, which is why I think, you know, people that need to take precautions should. We should be aware that, you know, it's present amongst us, but at the same time, we can start to feel a lot more normal. And I think you're seeing that, you know, as people are enjoying the Lakes region, the Mount Washington Valley, tourist season is here. It's been a wet July, but I think it is a July and people are enjoying it. So,
yeah, they are. I know that the session is out right now, and I know that you're going to be taking a little vacation.
Yeah, I'm not going to be available to do this interview for a few weeks, and that's why I asked Brody to fill in for me, and maybe, you know, in the future we can tag team and do something.
Oh, you're breaking up a little.
An up-and-coming member, if he isn't already, he really is, of the legislature, and he's done a great job of, you know, representing Wolfboro and Carroll County. So good to share some airtime with him.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, Senator. Greatly appreciated. And, you know, thank you so much for your effort on the SB 85, the broadband initiative that you, Senator Hennessy, and Senator Gaida just recently got the governor to sign. That's going to bring high-speed internet to the North Country, Carroll County, Grafton County, Coos County, and so many small businesses in Wolfboro.
Well, that was it was really the governor's leadership a year ago when he dedicated $50 million in CARES money to broadband expansion in rural areas. unfortunately, the federal law was such that it had to be expended by the middle of December, so it could be accounted for by the end of December, and there was only about $14 million that was able to get out and be expended in that fashion because of the tight timelines insisted upon by the feds. And what we've done now is with a matching grant program. It's funny, I was just talking to somebody the other day about the sandwich situation. So they're partnering with a co-op. So there's going to be private money, i.e. co-op, presumably some matching from Sandwich, and they're going to be eligible for the state grants that will be paid for with federal funds that we're getting from the, new relief act, so to speak. And that's going to go a long ways to getting, broadband in the rural areas of the state. Now, I have to say, being from Wolfboro, Paul O'Brien did a remarkable job as a select board member in Wolfboro of negotiating with the providers, CCI, and I think the other was Atlantic Broadband, to cover two areas that had, less than stellar service. And, I can't remember the exact number of homes. Brody, maybe you do. That O'Brien's efforts made possible for broadband expansion. But, he did that on his own initiative. Now it's going to be a lot easier for whether it's county committees like Carroll County Broadband or towns to be able to implement areas where their contracts in the past have, it's just been unfeasible because of economics, to run the wires down every back road and every dirt road, so to speak. And we've got a lot of them in Carroll County.
Yeah, we do. When do you think that this project will spin up, as it were, and actually start stringing wires?
So it's going to be housed at the Bureau of Economic Affairs. There was some reorganization of state government, a new Department of Energy that is incorporating the Office of Strategic Initiatives that was responsible last summer to implement the, grant program. So it's going to Taylor Caswell's Department, Economic Affairs. He's in the process of hiring people to actually administer the program. I would expect that, they'll be hired fairly shortly, and then obviously guidelines have to be written and things like that. But hopefully we're able, especially in a case of a town like Sandwich, which has almost no penetration of broadband, able to, get the money into the communities and the providers' hands to actually string some wires, this fall and hopefully before, the snow flies.
That quickly? Wow.
That's the hope.
Right.
So there's a process. It's government money, so there, there has to be accountability and, that kind of thing. So it's not just, free money hanging on a tree, go spend it type of thing. So, as I said, people hired, program guidelines, rules written, but I think we all know that this needs to be expedited.
I think you're right. 12:14 here on WASR. We're talking with Senator Jeff Bradley. Also, State Representative Brody Deshaies is with us. And Brody, again, thanks for making the time to come in, as you'll be kind of transitioning to be filling in for the senator when he takes his vacation.
Yeah, huge shoes to fill, but I'm more than happy to try and to fill those shoes while he's on vacation in Colorado with family. But
I don't know. Right now I'm wearing flip flops, so I don't think that's very huge, Brody. You'll do fine.
Yeah. So something that I want to talk about is this new Department of Energy that we just created in the new budget and everything, and how that's gonna that's really gonna significantly streamline bureaucracy and create efficiency. So I kind of want to get your perspective on that, Senator Bradley, about this new Department of Energy, and kind of put to rest, this idea that we've created a new agency and created, more jobs, more bureaucracy, that actually we're making government more efficient and more effective for Granite Staters.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Look, Chris Sununu is an engineer, okay? And engineers tinker, and they try things. and they want to make things work. And they're always thinking about, you know, in Sununu's case, how do you make government more effective and more efficient? And you see it happening in the private sector all the time, where mergers and acquisitions happen, and you're able to consolidate and become more effective in your mission. And that's been a part of, you know, the United States economy for a long, long time. And you should look at government through that lens, too. So by creating a Department of Energy that incorporates strategic initiatives and the Public Utilities Commission under one roof, I think is going to streamline. It's not going to add, you know, new positions to any of those departments, is my understanding. But it's also going to highlight the importance of a valid energy plan in New Hampshire. An energy plan needs to, you know, kind of be all of the above, especially in New Hampshire's case, where we don't have a lot of our own indigenous resources. So, you know, we need to develop more sources of generation of electricity, not just in New Hampshire, but in New England. We haven't had a hot summer, but certainly there are the possibility of supply constraints if we, you know, start reaching peak loads. And so whether it's natural gas, which is clean and a bridge fuel to the future, you know, continued operation of Seabrook, renewables, you know, where the governor is going to sign a net metering bill that will allow municipalities to get into larger net metering scale projects in a couple of weeks that my friend Kevin Avard from Nashua sponsored. You know, there are a lot of things that I think with a new direction and a new emphasis on energy is going to be helpful. And one of those is going to be offshore wind. We have a lot of potential, you know, for offshore wind. The prices are coming down. Obviously, you've got to be price conscious when you're doing, you know, any kind of energy. But offshore wind mitigates some of the, you know, concerns about both solar and wind being intermittent. Offshore wind, the wind tends to blow a lot more on the ocean than it does inland. And so instead of a 30% capacity factor, you have a much higher capacity factor. And with battery technology, you know, developing fairly quickly and becoming, I mean, it's all, the technology is obviously there. It's making it marketable and affordable. Then we're going to have a new energy future, a new paradigm in energy when you can store, you know, solar, wind, hydro, even tidal power in the future. That's going to change, you know, the way that we do an awful lot of things in this world. And that's a good thing. Having a Department of Energy, I think, that's forward-thinking is pretty helpful. But, you know, I think the one thing I always say is energy is absolutely essential to everything that we do. And having a reliable, cost-effective sector, excuse me, of energy resources means you've got to have enough capabilities, whether it's gas or even, you know, a little bit of coal or oil as backup, and we still have, you know, those as peaker plants, and then transitioning to renewables, nuclear is part of that picture. Diversification is really important, and energy needs to be clean, but it also needs to be smart, and it needs to be cost effective.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. And a lot of people in Wolfboro don't even realize that about two-thirds of our energy that we get in our lines in this town is actually from the Seabrook nuclear power plant. But I just, you know, I'm a big supporter of offshore wind, too. I just had a brief kind of question about how would that affect the fishing industry? Because I've seen in Rhode Island where right now they're holding up their project for offshore wind because they have fears that it's going to get in the way of their squid industry. Actually, they have a huge squid industry in Rhode Island, which I never really realized.
Who knew?
I know, right? Yeah, they have one of the largest on the East Coast.
Yeah, you don't think about where your squid comes from.
No, for real, but a lot of our calamari in New England actually comes from Rhode Island. So, but
when I go to Wolf Trap, I just like the calamari that, you know, that they make at the Wolf Trap, one of Wolfboro's venerable restaurants. So I'd never heard that problem. But look, you know, when you think about the fishing industry in New England, it has been changed dramatically and forced to downsize by, you know, protective measures adopted by the feds over the years to protect the ground stock of species like cod and haddock and halibut and, you know, other species on George's Bank. And that goes back to the days when I was in Congress. And believe it or not, Brody, working with Barney Frank, who was a champion of, you know, the New Bedford fishing fleet, I was worried about Seabrook and Portsmouth and Hampton, you know, where there were boats. You know, we tried to make sure that policies were balanced. So I think that there's no reason why, just from a lot of other things, if cited appropriately, these, you know, whether it's the fishing industry or the offshore wind, can't coexist. You need to, you know, do the technical reviews and things like that. But, you know, I don't see a reason at this point that things should be held up.
Mm-hmm. I certainly agree. The state of Maine, I'm pretty sure, has found some pretty ingenious ways to balance both.
Yeah, I know there was a Massachusetts project that's being held up off Cape Cod as well.
That's related to the Rhode Island project.
Okay, they're related. Okay.
Yeah, pretty interesting. I was reading all about it and stuff. The Biden administration's had a hard time because part of the Massachusetts project too has to do with its historic lands to Native Americans. So they have a tribe still on Nantucket that's organized that, you know, has lobbied the federal government not to put windmills there. So that's something to consider. I don't know if we have that problem in New Hampshire for offshore wind, but, you know, very interesting stuff.
There's also, you know, onshore wind projects. The biggest one I know here is in Plymouth. If you go up the Tenney Mountain Highway and you look up at the ridge, if coming from 93, exit 26, Tenney Mountain Highway, and you're headed that way, there's just, as far as you can see, just windmills.
Yeah, there are about 40 or 45 windmills that dot the mountains around Newfound Lake. I actually, several years ago, took a boat ride on that lake with some people that were pretty concerned about the impact of the ridgelines and, you know, the 45 or so, and they were about 1 megawatt wind machines.
Is that each, Senator?
Wind mitigates those issues. Okay, you're not going to see it, first of all. You know, what people say who live near windmills is that several things. The noise of the mechanics of the windmill can be really loud if you're within, you know, half a mile of a turbine. And even, you know, you can hear them from further away, but certainly anybody close, it's really impactful. And secondly, all these new windmills are higher than 200 feet, so you have to have red, you know, flashing beacons for air traffic. And so they produce that shadow that goes across everybody's window who happens to be in the path of them, a red light shadow. It could be, I've seen it before, very distracting. That being said, you know, I've been out to the island of Vinyl Haven in the coast of Maine several times, and, you know, they have three windmills. They're landmarks in the middle of the island. There are not too many homes near them. At least that's not – it doesn't appear that way. I've been fairly close to them. There is some noise, but not an inordinate amount, and it provides all of the electricity for – not all of the electricity because they don't run all the time, but a lot of the electricity for those islands. Same thing in Gloucester, Massachusetts. There are three big windmills on the hill that's right at the end of Route 128. How big, how many megawatts they produce, I'm not sure, but a megawatt generally powers about 10,000 homes. And so, you know, it's an important part of our energy future, but onshore wind, unless it's in a place like Vinyl Haven, where the wind is blowing much of the time, or Gloucester, even, where those windmills are, no more than half a mile from the water. Maybe, yeah, I'd say half a mile. And so the wind's blowing most of the time. But in other locations where you only get a 30% capacity factor, you still need to have redundant backup to be able to, you know, power people's homes and businesses 24/7. That's essential. And that's why battery technology, when it's affordable and practical, is so important.
Does trash to energy fit into this new matrix? Because let's face it, dumping is expensive. It has environmental consequences down the line. But on the other hand, it's not that clean, but technology can help that. Or is it just non-economical?
So several years ago, when there was a debate about the wood chip industry and independent power plants, there was another independent power plant outside of Concord, operated by Wheelabrator, that was a trash-to-energy facility. And we had one in Claremont that closed. The technology has improved dramatically, okay? So, you know, I'll leave it up to the experts to argue about whether it's safe or not safe, where it's located and the proximity to, you know, people's homes and the spreading of, you know, toxic chemicals like mercury. I think there is an impact, and I think we have to be really careful. It has to be cited very, very cautiously. But this is what the Department of Environmental Services testified to at the hearing on these bills, because that question came up about the Wheelabrator facility in Penacook. And they have a hierarchy of priorities and how best to dispose of trash. Number one, reuse things. Don't take it to the dump. Reuse if you can. Number two, recycle. Number three, incineration as a means of disposal. And number four is landfill. So we're in the middle of a big debate about, you know, landfill capacity in New Hampshire. It is something that we can't avoid because every one of us generates trash. I think every person tries to recycle and getting better at it as individuals, but the Chinese have closed the markets for a lot of recycled goods. And so, you know, the bottom has fallen out of plastic. Cans are still recyclable. Paper is recyclable on some sort of a, you know, economic basis. But glass and plastics are problematic right now. You know, so incineration does become an option. Landfilling is, you know, a necessary evil, so to speak. But people have probably objected even more vociferously to incineration than landfills. Both are problematic, no question. Both need to be cited, if at all, very carefully.
Yeah, I heard up north there was a company that ended up with 150,000 gallons of runoff water that thankfully they had a containment pond for. But... You know,
that was the Casella landfill in Bethlehem.
There's been a huge
debate about that because it was Casella that wants to build a second landfill in Dalton because the two they operate in the North Country are out of capacity within a 2025, 2026 time frame. So it's easy to just say, don't build more landfills. And it may well be that this proposed landfill in Dalton should not be permitted based on the permitting, you know, criteria that is done with scientific studies and the, you know, research that the Department of Environmental Services will do. I don't have any opinion on that. But I thought it was premature to say we're going to create a big buffer around just state parks because that was just singling out one site. Obviously there are more than one state park, but it was targeted at one site that hadn't even gone through the permitting process. What about the White Mountain National Forest? What about other conservation land or National Wildlife Refuge or, you know, town parks or conservation areas? I think that the way to ensure that we have the proper landfill criteria is to look at the permitting criteria and make sure that we're using, you know, really the best science and the best criteria to, as well as we possibly can, ensure, you know, safe disposal. But let me also give the flip argument too, Eric. If we don't have landfill capacity in this state, we're either going to have to build municipal or state-run facilities that could refuse to accept trash from other states, or if we don't build private facilities, our trash is going to have to go to states to take it. And guess what? That'll cost an arm and a leg. Mm-hmm. And people are already complaining about, you know, the cost of their property taxes, rightfully so. That cost will be much, much higher than it is today as tipping fees. You know, the cost of disposing of landfills goes through the roof.
Oh, yeah.
We have to truck out of state. And, okay, here's the other thing. The part of the pitch made by Casella, so to speak, if we are not taking all of those trucks up and down, you know, the roads, I think it was the equivalent of 29,000 cars would be taken off New Hampshire Highway. So they're burning fuel, too, and wear and tear on state roads. So, like everything else, it's a real balancing act. And I think, you know, we needed to be cautious. I have no trouble looking at, and I think we probably should, you know, tightening up permitting requirements. The good news is on the leak that they had engineered it to a point that the retention pond caught all of the contaminants that were released by a pump that, you know, failed to work over a weekend and nobody was there to see it. And maybe that's an issue too, that, you know, there needs to be better monitoring in off hours at any of these landfills to make sure that doesn't happen. But that's what I mean by tightening permitting requirements.
The other thing we can get from landfills is methane recapture. I've seen those before. I don't know how much methane you get out of a landfill, but I, you know, do you think that's a factor in favor of building one?
Well, certainly building another one. The facility is harvesting methane, and if people remember driving up and down Route 16 a few years ago, there was, you know, a lot of construction and clearing on the, you know, be the southbound, you know, right away. For pipelines that went from Turnkey to the University of New Hampshire to help power the university system. So, yes, methane can be captured from landfills. But the fact of the matter is, until we're a trash-free society, you know, it's one of the facts of life that we've got to learn to deal with in the most cost-effective and environmentally acceptable fashion.
Yeah, the problem is the cheaper the like those plastic clamshells. Damn, I hate those things. You know?
I couldn't agree more, Eric. I mean, and that is the whole point. You know, but think about the way that plastics have revolutionized our lives in terms of sanitation of food products too. So,
sure.
You know, you can't just arbitrarily say, okay, we're gonna ban this or ban that. You've got to balance the science, and you've got to test the hypotheses, and you've got to, you know, you've got to debate it fully. And there is a cost-benefit analysis, like anything else, on any of these public policy issues that comes into play. We all want the cleanest possible environment, but we also have to be able to afford, you know, what we do. And you know, if we were to ban plastics, then, you know, food preparation and food sanitation changes too. And that would have, you know, could have a pretty harmful impact. So
I'm not in favor of banning plastics. Never have been. But I've heard the argument before that the world spun on its axis just fine before plastic. I don't agree with it. I just, those plastic clamshells, I know they're cheap. They're, you know, easy to do from a packaging point of view. but boy, they drive you crazy. And how many of us have cut ourselves trying to cut those things open?
You know, mm-hmm. I think about the plastic straws and plastic bags, and you know, the Democrats in the legislature back in, I believe it was 2019, tried to ban plastic bags and plastic straws, and you know,
and some towns have.
Yeah, and some towns have, and that, you know, that's you know, they're trying to do good. You know, you can't get upset with someone who's trying to do something when their heart's in the right place. But the side effects of that would be people with arthritis or people who have disabilities. They would have a harder time carrying their groceries because they can't hold, you know, a paper bag, right, when they leave the store. And also plastic straws. I mean, that's people with disabilities, with physical disabilities, sometimes need to drink at restaurants out of a plastic straw. And I guess you could say, you know, they could use paper straws instead. But still, trying to eliminate all that that kind of plastic had that unintended consequence. And sometimes we don't think about that. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't see the forest through the trees, if you will.
I understand, Senator, you're under a time constraint.
I am. So Brody's going to take over for me and enjoy the next few weeks. And, you know, look forward to talking with you again soon.
Yeah, look, be safe, and we'll talk to you when you come back to New Hampshire. Enjoy your time on vacation.
All right. Take care. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. It is 12:36 on WASR. Thank you very much for listening. As always, 569-5253 is our phone number. As we talk about that, what, as long as we're on the subject of recycling and things like that, is it a state function to look into making new markets for this recycled material?
I'm not entirely sure how the state could create a new market. You know, I don't know if it's a state's responsibility, but even if
let's say hypothetically
that we accept it as a state legislature, that the state does have a responsibility to ensure that there's a market for recycling. You have to find a purchaser, right? And based on the way, you know, that it's typically third world countries that break down these plastics, that rebuild the packaging, that sell it back to producers, whether it's in those third world countries, you know, in a country like China, manufacturer. Or, you know, in America, right, they'll break down the plastic and sell it to producers in America, too. They're refusing to take our plastic because they have so much excess plastic and because recycling has become very inefficient, right? You have a lot of people who recycle stuff that actually can't be recycled. A lot of people don't realize that. The majority of, you know, the things that we think we can recycle really actually can't be recycled.
Right. And even is like when it comes to glass, you have to separate it by color.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a very labor-intensive process. It's a very inefficient process, but still it's an important part of something that we need to do to create more sustainability in the state and across this country, and you know, even internationally, is ensuring that we're recycling and that we're doing our due diligence, and you know, even as consumers, being responsible consumers and ensuring that the products that we buy are sustainable. So that in my personal opinion, you know, if someone wants to ensure that they're doing what's best for the environment, they don't necessarily need to look to government. They should be looking at what their consumer habits are, right? Because if we all as individual consumers recognize that, you know, some of our consuming habits aren't necessarily the most environmentally friendly, to, you know, to address that in your personal life. And then that also, you know, people can consider, you know, what kinds of whether they have physical disabilities and they can't do a specific thing that the government might want them to do, or etc. You know, if it's an individual decision, then there's flexibility. There's a lot of flexibility there.
I don't know if you've seen it up on 28 by the VFW in Alton. They've got this big thing, a can drive for the Boy Scouts. They've had it all through the spring and summer. Yeah. And I think they've filled it like five times, you know, because I drive by it every day on my way to work. That's a lot of cans. But which brings me to the question, is it time for a bottle bill?
A bottle bill. Interesting. So that's actually kind of interesting, because I was talking with some legislators who have previously worked on a bottle bill in the state of New Hampshire. And it can be very, very difficult, because the bottle bill at the same exact time is also a tax on manufacturers of the bottles, right? So the state, if I'm not mistaken, how a bottle bill would work is the state withholds a certain amount of, you know, money from the manufacturers of the, you know, the bottling plants, and then they kind of pay back consumers with, you know, that certain amount of money that they've held aside for consumers to bring back the bottles and stuff.
Right, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. Like, you know, growing up in Massachusetts, when I worked in a liquor store, we had a very large area dedicated to cans and bottles and all of that. And we do probably 2 trailer loads a week. It was a very big liquor store, Cappy's Liquors in Peabody, if anybody's ever seen it, right across from the North Shore Shopping Center. But I wonder, I mean, you know, you every time you pick up a bottle of something, it says, you know, Maine deposit, Hawaii deposit, you know, lists all
the
states.
Yeah, I believe it's Maine, Michigan,
yeah,
Hawaii,
I think it might be on
California.
The top of your can.
It probably
think,
would be on the top
I think
of
it is.
Can.
They print it there. No, on the top.
Yeah, I looked at the top. It just has the has a U.
Oh, they didn't print it on that one? That must be a New Hampshire can, as we used to call them.
Yeah, probably. But a bottle bill would be an interesting idea, and I've talked to other legislators about it. It's just you have to get buy-in from the bottling manufacturers, right? The people who are bottling drinks in this state, you know, so that's like Anheuser-Busch, the Coca-Cola mm-hmm. company. You know, you have to get buy-in from those manufacturers and stuff. And so you could try to find a way to make it so that it's not as much of an economic hindrance on them. But I think it's something worthy of considering. I'm not sure if it's something that would be ready for the works next session, so this upcoming year. But, you know, I'm a pretty open-minded guy. I understand that, you know, we need to create more incentives to make it so then people are recycling and being responsible. But at the end of the day, I still hold that, you know, it's personal responsibility, and it's sometimes it's a local issue too. Like Wolfboro has a great recycling program where we're able to, you know, have our citizens divvy up the recycling the way that they're supposed to at our town's transfer station. And we actually make money off selling our recyclables to, you know, to manufacturing plants down in Massachusetts that break it down to sell it to manufacturers again. And in the bottles too and stuff. So we actually, you know, we have a pretty good setup in Wolfboro, and I would encourage other communities to copy Wolfboro in our sustainability, but also not only our sustainability, but, you know, there's a certain amount of fiscal responsibility in doing that too. So mm-hmm. we make it so we're not increasing your property taxes in this community.
Well, as I understand it, a recycled can costs less to make than a new one. So, it, you know, or a recycled anything tends to cost less than a new one and uses less energy and all of those things.
I never realized that. I thought it was the other way around.
Oh, no, actually, from everything I've seen, that it's much more energy efficient to recycle it than it is to make a new one. Mm-hmm. So the $64,000 question is, would that, do you think, be enough to get buy-in from the bottlers or from the people that make, you know, drinks and soda and iced tea and all of that?
I'm not sure. I haven't spoken with them.
All right. Well, that's fair.
Yeah. It's something, you know, it is something. I have a list of, you know, legislative ideas that I keep on my phone and my notes. And, you know, I'll talk to people who I know are experts in specific. Every legislator that's in Concord of the 400 of us, you can find someone who's an expert in something. And someone who's a big expert in sustainability and environmental policy is actually a Democrat who, you know, I consider a good friend, is Representative Suzanne Smith, mm-hmm. right? She lives out in Hebron. And, you know, I brought the idea to her, and she has worked on this in the past. And it's, you know, it's a pretty tough hurdle trying to get buy-in from, you know, because sometimes when you want to make it so then the bottlers are more, you know, willing to go along with the bill, environmentalists will say now the bill doesn't go far enough. So it's about, like Senator Bradley just mentioned, you know, previously with a number of these issues, striking a balance. And I think we could strike a balance on that kind of legislation. And it's something that I've explored. And it's very funny that you brought it up, actually, because, you know, I explored it only about a month ago, talking to a few legislators about it, Republicans and Democrats. And there's a certain amount of willingness, but it would have to be done the correct way as to, you know, not increase, you know, costs on bottlers and increase cost on consumers, but at the same exact time ensure that, you know, the bill's actually going to have some teeth and make it so then people are, you know, have the proper incentives to recycle.
Right. Out of curiosity, just as not as a state rep, but as a consumer, what do you think a bottle deposit should be? I know some states are nickels, some states are a dime. You know, is less more? I think a nickel is plenty on a container.
You know, I'm not sure. And, you know, it's tough to tell because I'm not sure how much incentive people have even to bring a bottle or a can back for a dime. right? I know there are some people who they'll collect a whole bunch of them so they can get a whole bunch of money for it, but I'm not sure if the average consumer really thinks about it when they grab a can that, you know, that they want to return it for that, you know, for that 10 cents in the states that offer that. So I'm not really sure. I'd have to see economic data, and I would have to understand, you know, more about how these programs work and, you know, what's worked and what hasn't worked. I believe the state of Vermont has a bottle buyback program too. And so that they would be someone that I think New Hampshire could look towards as a state that's, you know, within our region with similar demographics and similar consumer habits. But I think you'd need more research to really, you know, pin something down and say what's the right amount to make a bottle deposit system worth it and, you know, incentivizing consumers. And, you know, what is going to be enough to make it so then you're not really putting a huge constraint on these bottle companies? Because, look, at the end of the day, you don't want to put a constraint on the bottlers in New Hampshire, right? They employ, you know, thousands of people in this state. They're important to making sure that people get the beverages that they love and enjoy on a summer day. So you don't want a legislation that's going to hurt them in the long run. But at the same exact time, there is a reality where, you know, it's something that we could explore and consider.
Well, I think that's, you know, I think you hit it right on the head that what we're doing, if you look at it as a macro, is unsustainable. You know, we as a society, we've got to do something. Unfortunately, the something, you know, you ask 50 people and you get 52 different opinions.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious, like Massachusetts bottle bill has always been cockeyed. It's only carbonated beverages. So iced tea or juice are not covered by the bill, where in Maine they are. And it's like, I'd love to talk to somebody from each of those states to get the pros and cons of how that works. I mean, to me, it would make sense. Carbonated or non-carbonated shouldn't make a difference. But I mean, maybe that was a political compromise at the time when they did it back in the 80s.
It could very well. And, you know, Maine is another state that we could consider, too, if we were to emulate a bottle bill like that, you know, to look and to find out why they've Massachusetts has done it the way that they've done it, and, you know, how that compromise came about and why Maine decided to go for, you know, all beverages that are bottled and canned in their state. So, you know, something that I think we can explore in the legislature and everything. There's like a, you know, I did vote for, you know, Senator Bradley brought this up earlier, is one thing that actually we disagreed upon was the landfill that they've cited up in up north of Bethlehem, the new one that's next to, I believe it's Silver Lake State Park. And I had a problem with, you know, because I understand that we need landfills, right?
Right.
But I also understand that, you know, it's not sustainable to be siting landfills everywhere. But I had a direct problem with it because this landfill was sited within 200 feet of a state park.
Okay.
So I do think that there should be, you know, I do think that we should consider, and, you know, we did consider it last session. I voted for the legislation twice, was to make it so then that we have a buffer zone around our state parks and our natural resources from these landfills and stuff, and from them being sited next to these state parks, you know, have a 2-mile buffer zone. Because we've seen what's happened, whether it's in Quebec or Bethlehem, where landfills leak, right? There's there's only one kind of landfill, you know, those that are going to leak and those that have leaked, right? Landfills leak. It's a normal thing, you know, and we have to be cognizant of that. But, you know, where this current landfill is sited up in the North Country next to Silver Lake in Dalton is next. It's within 200 feet of a state park. It would destroy 17 acres of wetlands, which is supposed to be protected by the state. And it would be it would take up about 250 acres, and it would be right, you know, glaring next to a state park that people frequent very regularly. And I find that troubling for our tourism industry, right? Wolfboro is dependent on tourism. The North Country, Conway, dependent on tourism. And to be siting landfills so close to, you know, pristine areas of our state that we should be protecting, you know, that we should ensure that future generations have, and that we recognize, you know, our greatest economic resource in Wolfboro and northern New Hampshire is, you know, our lakes, our waters, our streams. It is our environment. So if we don't protect that environment, if we aren't stewards of our environment, then we're giving up a huge economic resource too. That's why even as a conservative, you know, I think conservation's important. It's in the word conservation too, to be conservative, to ensure that, you know, you're protecting those resources, and there's economic benefit and there's also intrinsic value in those kinds of resources too.
Which brings up a very interesting question, Brody Deshaies, by the way, here on WASR, where it's 12:50. Maybe some rain this afternoon. We'll find out. There's a chance of it anyway. Thunderstorms. We'll keep an eye on it for you. Anyway, the $64,000 question with that is, if I can find a way to put it, I completely lost my train of thought. I knew it.
Well, I'll keep picking.
I remember. Okay. I remember now. So when we put the landfill in, right, it's got to go someplace.
Of course. Right? Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't have landfills,
right,
because there are some you know, some pro-environmental folks who will say we shouldn't have land. No. It's about where you site these landfills.
Now I remember what I was going to say. I knew it took me a while. Why do you think the Democrats tend to get more credit for talking about the environment and environmental protection than Republicans do?
Because Republicans have ceded the ground on that issue. I think there are many Republicans who do support our environment. They just support it in a different way, right? The Republicans are more about balancing the needs of protecting the environment and those resources for citizens, but also the needs of, you know, ensuring that we have a robust economy and that people are that people aren't hindered by, you know, by environmental protections that could, you know, hurt our economy. And so I think in New Hampshire, Republicans have really found, and people like Governor Chris Sununu have really found a way to, and, you know, Senator Jeb Bradley too with his net metering bills, we've really found a way to increase, you know, the market's share of renewable energies in our energy sector. We've really found a way to protect our resources. And I thought, you know, and the specific bill number is House Bill 177. It was a bipartisan bill. There were Republicans and Democrats on the bill. You know, a Republican senator and a Democrat state senator. So it was a very bipartisan bill. It was a bipartisan effort to create that 2-mile buffer zone. And people were very willing to lower that buffer zone to even less than a mile, just recognizing that, you know, probably siting these landfills that close to a state park is asking for trouble. And it's asking, you know, it's asking for a decrease in our meals and rooms tax money, right? Because you're going to have less people visiting these state parks, going on day trips there. It's asking for future costs of having to mitigate, you know, a possible spill in the, you know, the normal the leakage that comes from these landfills. I found in many ways that it was a pragmatic solution, a bipartisan solution to preventing landfills from being sited in a place where I thought was, you know, a little bit not the most responsible place to put a landfill. And you know, at the end of the day, we'll have to keep working. And, you know, I know Senator Bradley and I have spoken about, you know, maybe making it so then that there's better standards for these landfills that are placed, even if they're placed, you know, that close to a state park. So that might be a good place where we can move forward and find even more bipartisan consensus and get the governor on board to help make sure that we have more sustainable landfills in this state.
Are those landfills regulated by the states, by the feds, or by a kind of combination?
I would say I don't know what the feds do to regulate them, but the feds almost regulate everything. So
right.
I'm going to make the bold assumption, you know, and it's not that bold of an assumption, but I'll make it that the feds also have that they must have some kind of regulations from the EPA on you know, all landfills. The state, it's New Hampshire DES is responsible, and, you know, we have it in statutory law of the siting process, and they, you know, they have public hearings, and there's an approval process for, you know, certain things that you need to build when building a and siting your landfills and everything. But I think a big thing to remember too, that folks need to remember, is this there's a lot of money that's involved in these landfills too. A lot of the trash that comes into New Hampshire is actually from Vermont, because they have stricter landfill laws. So it's easier for a company like Casella and cheaper for them to build their landfills here. And a lot of the garbage is shipped in from out of state. So it's not all garbage from the state. The majority of it, believe it or not, is actually from other states. That was something that I learned, you know, during the public hearings I was on this legislation, and in talking to one of the co-sponsors of the bill, Republican from COAS District 1, Stewartstown, most northern district in New Hampshire, Representative Dennis Thompson. But, you know, we have to remember, you know, not only that, but Casella is also, you know, in the town of Dalton, the original deal that they set up was to pay the Dalton taxpayers their tax bill for somewhere between 15 and 25 years. So basically to cover their town's budget. So they've set up, you know, they've set up a major monetary incentive for the people of Dalton to approve of this project, which the people of Dalton actually denied it in their local town elections, even still, you know, being offered 20 years of their town's budget to be covered, a town of 500 people, albeit, but still, you know, so they tried to dangle, you know, a huge bunch of bait in front of the hook to get the town of Dalton to, you know, be more than gung-ho to place this next to a state park. And the thing is that this garbage isn't going to entirely alleviate New Hampshire's garbage needs. It's alleviating New England's garbage needs, which, you know, I can definitely see that perspective that we should consider how, you know, how we can create more sustainable landfills in all of New England, and that New England's garbage needs to go somewhere. But I would hate for it to be at the expense of our tourism industry in New Hampshire, our property taxpayers, our state taxpayers, which is disproportionately small businesses like the ones we have in Wolfboro. I would hate for us to make a short-term decision off of, you know, Casella's ability to pay the town of Dalton's budget and, you know, our short-term saying, well, we need a place to put garbage, rather than looking at the long-term sustainability of, is it smart to put landfills within 2 miles of our state parks, and is our current, you know, is our current consumer trends that we have, and is the current way that we're, you know, that we're disposing of our garbage, is that really going to be sustainable, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years down the road? And those are tough issues that we're going to have to look at today, because you can't, once the problem really blows up in your face, it's very hard to remedy. Right. Dealing with it today, you know, we can come up with some common sense remedies to ensure that these issues don't get out of hand.
Well, once the genie gets out of the bottle, you're right. That's
exactly
going to be a
problem. So we're looking today for the future.
How exactly would that be done? As a state representative, you say, okay, you know what? I'm going to start learning about landfills. Mm-hmm. Where would be the first place you would go for information?
Well, first is you have to understand that, you know, finding people within your community, right? So maybe going to the waste service, you know, folks in Wolfboro. But even more is understanding that you can reach out to New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services, because they're responsible for the landfills in the state and regulating them, and speaking with them about the regulations and maybe any kind of shortfalls that they see in those regulations. And even in Concord, too, with 400 representatives, there's going to be experts on specific issues. And someone who I've really met within the Republican caucus, who's also a freshman legislator, is a legislator named Dennis Thompson, who for about 30 years, his job has been to help build retaining walls on these landfills, right? And to help, you know, make sure that they're up to federal and state regulations. And he was one of the people that introduced this bill, you know, this 2 mile buffer zone, because he said, I've built some of these landfills. I've worked on construction sites on these things. I have a construction company that works on, he specifically does construction for environmental preservation. And he says, you know, landfill within 2 miles of a state park is asking for trouble. So, you know, it's going to those resources and finding those people and understanding, for example, Dennis Thompson and I want to go on a tour of the city of Berlin's transfer station and their dump, because their landfill in Berlin is considered one of the best in New England how they do their regulations.
What's unique about it?
What's unique about it is that they actually will, you know, they'll fund the manpower to ensure that everyone is looking at every load of garbage that's being dumped into the landfill, right? And that they have special kinds of their retaining walls. They have better retaining walls as compared to regular dumps. They have better technology that they've used. It's more modernized and there's more regular investment because it's a public dump. And they have the public workers that are there that are really looking at the kind of garbage that's going into it. And if they see something that, you know, being put into their landfill that isn't supposed to be put into landfills against EPA and state regulations, there's someone who's actually there who saw that and, you know, will say to the company, you got to pull that garbage out and take it to the proper place. Where with private landfills, you don't have that kind of, you don't have that care and that, that constant due diligence, right? And that's kind of, you know, when we think about this garbage and the harmful effects it can have on, for example, in Bethlehem, that dump that's there, the town of Bethlehem has to actually pay $300,000 a year. $300,000 a year to pump some of the groundwater from the leaching of that landfill to prevent it from getting into people's drinking water. So that's a normal town expense that they have to go through. And, you know, and we need to look at how these landfills not only affect, you know, the environment, not only how they affect our tourism industry, but how they can affect people in abutting areas and stuff, and how it affects property taxpayers in small communities.
Right. Unfortunately, we are out of time. It is 1 o'clock, pardon me, here on WASR. Brody Deshaies, thank you again for filling in for Senator Bradley, at least for the second part of the show, and we will talk to you next week. And, of course, don't forget, Brody is the host of All Things Politics every other Wednesday here on WASR, so it won't be this Wednesday, the next Wednesday. However, Wednesday's show is up as a podcast, as all the shows here are, at WASR.net. Thanks again for being with us, and enjoy your weekend.
Thank you for having me, Eric. Have
News
a great
is
weekend.
Next. It's 1 o'clock.